Okay, so that's with bacon, cheese, lettuce, tomato, grilled onions, ketchup, and hold the pickles.
You know what you like. You wouldn't order your burger just any way. Why should your sports talk be any different? With Chapters on the free Odyssey app, you can choose the topics that matter to you most. Whether it's reactions, matchup previews, injury updates, or team news, quickly find what you really care about. Your football talk, your way. Download the free Odyssey app and start listening today.
Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We come to eighth time. Let's get to work in, man. Let's go.
Great day. Great day. Oh, give me some juice, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Monday to all of you. Nice to be with you. Appreciate you getting up with us. What's going on? Hope you had a nice holiday. Hope you had a great weekend of watching football. We are here for you today. We're here till 8 a.m. as usual on a Texans Monday, even though the Texans played on Wednesday of last week, which threw everything off for me and others. But we're here now, man. We're back on a normal schedule on a normal week.
And we're ready to fight.
We're ready to rock, man.
Amon Thompson.
Thank you, Amon Thompson, for getting our game faces on last night.
That was good.
We hadn't seen... good morning, by the way. How are you? I missed you.
I'm good.
Yeah, it's been a few days.
Yeah, it's been a weird... It's weird. That Wednesday game threw me for a loop more than I thought it would.
Dude.
Yesterday I had to remind myself. I was just kind of humming along, doing my stuff. And then... And because I had watched football on Saturday, it kind of caught me by surprise at noon that, oh, wait, there's football again today.
Yeah, it's wild.
Kind of. There's a very few meaningful games left.
No, but it was American football on television, and we watched it. It was so that was fun. Yeah, the Rockets last night. Man, we hadn't had one of those with them in a while. Remember last year where it felt like every other game there was some sort of Pier 6 brawl during it at some point?
Yeah. It was one of those things where, okay, they're making some progress here and they're doing some good things. But a lot of times we were just happy to have a fight.
Yeah.
Whereas yesterday I'm kind of like, well, yeah, the fight's good and all, but also I would have liked to beat the Heat.
Yeah, Tyler Hero got hand in that whole thing. As I'm watching it, I'm like, he is the guy that can point at the scoreboard. For those who missed it, if you weren't up last night watching the Rockets, they lost to the Miami Heat. So they've lost two straight now, and they've blown big leads in both games. Minnesota game on Friday, they blew a 16-point lead midway through the fourth quarter. That was bad.
Yeah.
That was really bad. Last night was a 12-point lead. They were down at the half. They went on a big run in the third quarter to take a 12-point lead. And the way the Rockets have played this year, Seth, it was like, I was like, okay, well, this is one of those teams they just take care of business against, and this will be just fine. And then the Heat went on a run. It was back and forth. It was a very defensive game. You know, game finished, I think both teams were under 100 in that game. But the big story was at the end of the game, as the referees were losing control, specifically Mark Davis was losing control of that game, Amon Thompson decided to grab Tyler Hero by the lapels and just toss him to the ground.
With great force and ferocity.
Yes.
It was so leading into it, it was there. The Rockets were down by four coming out of timeout. The 47 seconds left. Fred VanVleet is having trouble inbounding the ball, calls a timeout, and the official, Mark Davis, doesn't see him call a timeout.
Yeah, he calls him for a 5-second violation.
So he calls him for a 5-second violation, and Fred VanVleet says, Sir, I called the timeout. And Mark Edwards says, there will be no objections. You will not question my authority. And he tossed Fred VanVleet, or he gave him a technical. He tossed him.
And then
within a few seconds, Amon Thompson's scrumming it up with Tyler Hero.
Yeah.
I would say it was just nobody at fault necessarily. They were both grabbing at each other. And then Amon Thompson was guilty of just making Tyler Hero look like a toddler.
Thompson.
Not that you would ever throw a toddler to the ground
No.
But, you know, let's pretend it's 1947 or something. Back when that was a discipline that you might have.
Right. Back when it was okay.
Back when that was just good parenting.
Mm-hmm. And then it turned into a big scrum. Nobody left the bench. It was all scrums with guys that were on the floor. You leave the bench, you're getting popped for big-time suspensions these days.
Jalen Green was... It's so hard to... There's so many things going on when you watch it. Jalen Green was shoved to the ground and had somebody on top of him.
Yeah.
It was actually kind of scary for him because there's all kinds of feet around and everything.
Yeah.
Shane Sengun was kind of being a peacemaker. It was a big old scrum.
Yeah,
would you call it a fight?
It was a fight by 2024 NBA standards. You know,
yeah.
It's very rarely do fists get thrown in these things anymore. You know,
Aziz Alshire wasn't out there.
No. But Amen Thompson.
Aziz will punch a dude.
No, but Amen Thompson made a good case to get put into the Circle of Swarm this Friday. There are no Texans to put in there after the performance on Christmas.
He's one of the swarmiest guys out there in Houston sports. He plays ferociously on defense.
Definitely one of the swarmiest guys in the NBA. He's getting a lot of love right now for like defensive player of the year type stuff, first team all defense. So that was kind of fun. You know, it was not fun that they lost, and it's not fun that they've lost two in a row. They're a relevant NBA team. They've been sitting at the two seed for the last couple weeks. We'll have audio from everybody involved a little bit later in headlines with that. But that was, in case you were going to bed early last night and you missed it, if you're up with us this morning and you're on vacation, we thank you for that. If you're up with us this morning and who farted? If you're up with us this morning and you're on your way into work, good for you. You know, I would recommend getting a job where they don't, you know, you don't have to go into work today or whatever. But we're here for you. We're here for you for the next couple hours. All right. So the Texans open as 3-point underdogs in Tennessee this coming weekend. The lines are out on week 18 of the NFL. And there's going to be some weird lines because there's a handful of teams that don't have anything to play for. There's a handful of teams that have no playoff positioning to play for. There's a handful of teams that whose fan bases at least would rather they lose than win. Makes it a little more difficult to handicap. This Texans opening as a 3-point underdog in Tennessee this coming weekend seems to be a line to me. And I know the Titans beat the Texans back in week 12. I get that. They beat them 32-27 at NRG Stadium. That was a game where the Texans had a pick six and eight sacks and still managed to find a way to lose to the Titans. Thank you, Kymie Fairbairn, for missing a field goal. But I would say even with that loss to the Titans in week 12, and even as poorly as the Texans have been playing, and make no mistake, they played their worst game of the D'Amico Ryans era on Christmas Day. That was their worst performance of the year. That might have been their worst performance under D'Amico Ryans. They didn't score any offensive points, and they lost 31-2. The Texans being a 3-point underdog at Tennessee is indicative of a line, at least, Seth, where Vegas is expecting the Texans to rest a lot of guys in this game.
I would say, I think it's a combo of them expecting to rest a lot of guys, but that also the Texans offense with nobody resting the other night looked wholly inept. And that there's probably a combo of, okay, the Titans had the Texans number last time they played them, but then also, if everybody rests, then it's gonna be even worse.
I would say, if anything, the Titans beating the Texans last time in NRG Stadium would factor positively. If this were a game that weren't in Week 18,
let's pretend
this was 2 weeks later, like last year's Titans game was.
Yeah.
I would think, if anything, because you look at that game and everything in the box score, other than two massive plays by the Titans, everything in the box score, if you put your hand over the final score, you would have said, okay, well, the Texans won this game. You know what I mean? Like they had a pick six in this game. They sacked Will Levis 8 times in this game. So I think this thing, you're right. I mean, any line is a combo of things. It's never just one thing.
Yeah.
But I would say there's zero chance that the Texans would be an underdog in Tennessee unless Vegas thought C.J. Stroud wasn't going to play in this game.
Yeah, if this was a game that mattered or what have you. And honestly, I'm at the point now where, all right, for several weeks I've been saying, man, they got to get something right with this offense. They got to figure it out. Okay, I know that the game with the Ravens might ultimately not matter that much. Maybe they don't even have a chance at the 3 seed, but I'd like them to possibly get the 3 seed and that they got to figure some things out offensively. That ship has sailed. That train has left the station.
Yeah.
The baby carriage is rolling down the hill. The best thing you can do right this moment is...
What's with you wanting to toss babies and roll them down hills this morning?
I don't know.
Was there a baby at your Christmas festivities this past week that bothered you? Or a toddler?
No, the youngest child that I interacted with was 10 years old, and we had a delightful conversation.
It's just interesting to me.
About
that's
cows.
All. Okay.
So, yeah, we're good. No, I don't know. I don't know. I was struggling to come up with a third analogy, and since the baby was fresh in my mind.
I got you.
The toddler was fresh in my
just
mind.
Checking.
I went
with
that one. So, you know, groups of three. It's always good to do things in groups of three. So, or do a thing to a three-year-old, toss a three-year-old.
Right.
So, so that ship has sailed, and the best thing you can do at this moment is at the very least get CJ as healthy as possible, get him rested. That game, and we'll talk about this later, you know, going back and watching, it's so frustrating because it's multiple things at multiple positions right now that they're tiny things here and there, but it all adds up to... It all adds up to a huge mess.
That.
Right, like, okay, man, if you could have held the pass protection for an eighth of a second longer, if Laremy Tunsil, like, we'll just say the missed opportunity to Dalton Schultz in the flat in that game. So CJ's throwing the check down, but Dalton Schultz stays in to try to pick up the blitz. Meanwhile, Laremy Tunsil is getting trucked backwards like he's a three-year-old. And that's just enough to delay the timing. If he had just gotten trucked back 6 inches less, that's probably a completion. Or if CJ maybe just maneuvers a little bit or makes the decision that much faster, it's a big completion and a first down.
Mm-hmm.
But you compound all of this, and especially now without Tank Dell or Stephon Diggs out there, there's just not enough speed on the field.
No.
There's just not enough speed, and it delays everything. And a couple of the sacks that CJ took... On the TV copy, I thought, all right, well, that's CJ's fault. He's got to get rid of the ball. And then you look and you see him like, man, all right, well, he's just waiting for Cade Stover to clear throw. He can throw to to Xavier Hutchinson. Like, so many instances like that. It's all these little micro fractions that add up to a disaster. And the only thing I can think of to fix that right now is, A, play Deontay Johnson because he's fast.
Yep.
And B, just get CJ as healthy as possible in the next 2 weeks.
Well, and so does that change your opinion? I know we got to get to a break here. Does that change it? Because there's rumors of him being banged up now. Does that change your opinion of him? You wanted him to play in this Tennessee game. Do you want him to play in this Tennessee game now?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
No, I just, not after that debacle from Wednesday. That, I won't even call it Christmas.
Yeah, I don't know how much, I'm with you on that. Like, so you and I are both thinking, like, I got to get these things fixed. What do you fix? How do you fix something that's been systemic for 17 weeks and 60 minutes against the Titans?
Yeah, is the offensive line all of a sudden going to be just nails at picking up games?
Yeah.
Is CJ going to be healthy? Is Xavier Hutchinson going to be faster? Or John? Like, it's all such a mess that the only thing you can do right now is just try to rest up and get as healthy as possible.
Well, they're practicing at 11:30 today. It's been a long weekend, so they are practicing today. And D'Amico Ryans meets with the media at 12:15. So we'll get some answers today, I would imagine.
I would say lay off doing like 16 half-gassers at the end of practice.
Yes.
Just go ahead and taper down for the playoffs.
Take it down. All right, we're off and running.
Taper down.
Yeah. Yep, we're off and running on a Monday. Good to be with you. We got you covered here all week long on sports. Seth and I are in all week. So we got you covered all week long here on Payne and Pendergast, Sports Radio 610. If you were watching football this weekend, you saw a Stephon Diggs commercial. I promise you saw it. Was this shade at the Texans? We will play it for you coming up next.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
All right, so the Texans, this is the situation. The Texans are 3-point underdogs in Tennessee. As we talked about in the open, that would seem to be a line that would indicate that your starting quarterback is not playing in that game. The Titans are one of the worst five or six teams in football. As bad as the Texans have played recently, and by recently I mean on Christmas, as bad as they played offensively all season long, they should not be an underdog to the Tennessee Titans on any field anywhere, including what will probably be a hapless, lifeless Nashville on Sunday. So there's that. Here's where they're at, Seth, with the playoffs and the standings. They cannot change their lot in life. They are now the four seed. That losing to the Ravens cemented that. They are the four seed in the postseason. There is a 75% chance. That sounds a little high to me, by the way. A 75% chance that they face the Steelers in the opening round of the playoffs. And the reason I say that sounds high to me The Steelers play the Bengals in Week 18. The Bengals are one of the hottest teams in football right now. If the Steelers lose and the Chargers beat, I believe they play the Raiders. They do. Yeah. They play the Raiders, which feels like an incentivized Chargers team. As hard as the Raiders have been playing under Antonio, but they're bad, but they've been playing hard under Antonio Pierce. that doesn't sound like something that has a 25% chance of happening, like the Steelers losing and the Chargers winning. The Chargers play a bad team. The Steelers play what I think is a good team, or the Bengals are a good team right now. They've won four in a row, and they are scoring points out the wazoo. That said, the computers are saying it's 75%. I would say it's the favorite, but 75% sounds a little bit high to me.
Right. So it's let's just say it's a toss-up between those
Chargers,
two teams.
Steelers,
it's going to be one of those. I do. There's a part of me that, if you want to make it as simple as the quarterbacks and his style of play and everything else goes with that, Russell Wilson's just still got too many blemishes in his game.
Yeah.
And that overall, even though they've done some good things offensively, I don't think it's anything that they can bank on. The fear would be, all right, but Russell Wilson to George Pickens, they've unleashed some bombs versus some good defenses, and the Texans' defense will generally play really, really well, except for the plays where they play atrociously.
Yeah.
And I could totally envision George Pickens having two long touchdowns against the Texans. But on the sum total of it, I just respect Justin Herbert more as a quarterback. And, you know, both those. The Chargers defense is good, but the Steelers defense is the Steelers defense. That's the only thing that swings me back over towards the Pittsburgh side.
Well, I think a big thing with Pittsburgh is the games at NRG Stadium. If they play the Chargers, it'll be a home field advantage. If they play the Steelers, it's gonna be half the crowd's gonna be Steeler fans.
Yeah, oh, good call.
I'm with you. Like, in the grand scheme of things, I think I'd rather play Pittsburgh and Russell Wilson. Especially, I'm probably a little traumatized after watching from beginning to end the Chargers and the Patriots, because it was our good friend Ross Tucker doing the color commentary on that game. Watched the entire game. The Chargers just steamroll a bad Patriots team. So I'm like, oh, this doesn't look like a team I'd want to play in the first round of the playoffs right now if I'm the Houston Texans. That's the only thing that's keeping me a little bit tentative about the Steelers is just what it's going to be the complete opposite of what the wild card round game was last year against the Browns, where it was one of those environments for Texan fans where you were like, wow, they're back. This feels like 2011 all over again.
What is the percentage chance that it's the Ravens? It's like 5%.
It's like 5%, right? Yeah.
Okay, we need that. I need that ticket to come in. If it's the Ravens, I cannot handle the week leading up to that game and the amount of pessimism and or just flat out apathy we're going to get from our listeners, or just the appropriate and justified doom and gloom that it would be if it was going to be the Ravens.
Yeah, we're already in a pretty strange
place. It's a pretty
place.
Doomy and gloomy
place. Yeah, it's already, regardless of who the opponent is. This offense has people very angry right now. I don't know if Stephon Diggs is angry or if he's just having fun, but if you missed it, Stephon Diggs, and we played some audio last week. Stephon Diggs is occupying his time these days doing two things: rehabbing his knee injury and doing Domino's commercials. You know, the commercials for the emergency pizza that Domino's likes to provide. He's providing, what is it, a million emergency pizzas or something like that to people over the course of the holiday football season here. This was a commercial Domino's did yesterday. Listen to the very end where the Domino's delivery lady brings up, seemingly, the Texans' offense.
When you order Domino's online, we'll give you a free pizza to use in the future.
Out for the season, Stephon Diggs will have to watch this one from home.
So you'll have an emergency pizza when you need it most.
Thank Did you? All was there a baby
only
at your
Domino's
Christmas festivities?
They really
this
missed
past
you
week?
Out there, huh?
Tell me about it.
Hang on. Okay, that was
we're
that
playing
audio.
That was the commercial added to you asking me about me hating babies.
Yeah. Jordan, it sounds like the opening segment is playing underneath that audio.
When you order Domino's online, we'll give you a free pizza to use in the future.
Out for the season, Stephon Diggs will have to watch this one from home.
So you'll have an emergency pizza when you need it most.
Thank you.
All good? Only at Domino's.
They really miss you out there, huh?
Tell me about it.
Oh!
Tell me about
it. They really miss you out there.
What the hell, Stefan?
Tell me about it.
It only took until the second to last day of the year. Well, yesterday was the third to last day of the year for Stefan Diggs to say something, this time on traditional media, not social media,
right,
that might be considered divisive. If this is a team where people actually were even checked in emotionally right now, they would be irate about this. That's messed up. It's messed up.
You're right. It was a good litmus test yesterday. I'm like, ooh, when I saw that commercial, I'm like, ooh, what's X saying about this right now? And there were a few people. They were like, hey, here's a thing that Stefan Diggs was not getting a lot of, Seth. Pushback on his opinion and his take about the second, about the Texans offense.
I'd love to argue with you, but yeah, it's kind of, especially with Tank Dell gone.
Yes.
And my big impression after watching the offense, you know, rewatching that game, which was a miserable experience, was, man, there's just not a lot of speed out there.
No.
Everything is plodding and slow and gunky, and it sure would be nice to have Tank, because Tank Dell and Stefan Diggs, whether they were producing or not, like at a high level, it was a problem for defenses. There's a lot of speed to be accounted for when those guys are out on the field.
Well, you know who was producing at a super, super high level with the two of them out there? Nico Collins.
Yeah.
You
good
know,
point, Sean.
Nico Collins. And Nico's still, you know, he's still, you know, 3 catches, 60 yards, 74 yards. But since coming back, he's had one 100-yard game.
Well, and there's just there have been too many drops by Nico.
Yeah.
It's not like he all of a sudden has horrible, horrible hands or anything. But there have been some big strikes that he's had opportunities to make in the last couple of weeks that he didn't make. Everything feels like you're running on fumes right now. And yes, they could use Stefan Diggs' speed out there. I could do without his shots at how bad they look without him. Dang it.
I was surprised by that. Watching that commercial, I'm like, did he basically just say, yeah, they sure do miss me?
You know how these shoots go. They probably had him read off 20 different lines, and that was the one that they liked, and it worked. I mean, he would have, I don't know, man.
Was he paying attention to all the lines he was reading? Like, literally, he just said, tell me about it.
He's got this reputation as a diva, and he doesn't want to be a diva, so he's like, I'm not going to sit here on the commercial set and say no. No, director, I will not read that line.
That's true. He didn't want to be a commercial diva.
So he ends up being a diva to his old team pointing out how miserable it is without him.
Does this affect at all your desire to have Stefan Diggs back as a Houston Texan next year?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
No, I'm not worried about it.
Me neither. Beggars can't be choosers. They probably will not. It looks like they won't have Tank Dell next year. You know what I mean? Like, you got to get guys. You need at least one other guy a defense respects, and actually that applies to this game against Tennessee in the postseason as well. They need another guy out there that defense has to respect. That ain't John Metchie. That ain't Xavier Hutchinson. It ain't Robert Woods. It ain't Jared Wayne. It's Deontay Johnson.
Not Jared Wayne, unless you want to have another Tank Dell situation. Kylie Wong had a similarly horrific knee injury. And, you know, Kylie was a linebacker, wasn't, you know, nearly, nobody's as fast as Tank Dell. But I remember he came back, he got injured midway through the 2005 season.
Okay.
And it was ugly. It was really bad. And I think he tore all his ligaments, the ACL, MCL, PCL. But he came back and played the next season and had a hard time with it. You know, that was D'Amico's rookie year. And I remember sitting in the training room with Kylie, who's just putting on a heroic effort to be out there playing, and I just relayed to him what Brandy had said while she was watching, which was that D'Amico makes all the plays that Kylie used to make, and I was saying it more as a compliment to D'Amico. And Kylie was just like, thanks, Seth.
Bro.
Thanks. Like, Kylie was there about to make the play, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, D'Amico comes flying in. And that was just kind of how it went for him that
I'm
year.
Looking at, and that was Kylie's last year. It was 2006.
Yeah.
He played 10 games, didn't start in any games, played in 10 games, and that was it. So that, well, that doesn't make me feel good about Tank.
Well, it's 20 years later, you know?
Yeah.
I gotta hope and think. It's funny, because I had multiple ACL tears in my career, or at least multiple ACL surgeries. I had a botched revision I had to do. And I used to think of myself kind of as an expert on ACL repairs. And then I realized in having a conversation with a doctor last year, like, oh, I don't know squat about how they do things these days.
Yeah, it's changed.
And he was explaining how they probably would do it differently this day and age and where maybe I would have recovered better, but whatever. So, yeah, I would hope that, especially with a lot of the, the growth factors and everything they use now, maybe it's way more realistic than it was back in the day.
I hope so, man. I hope so. I feel horrible. I feel horrible for Tank. Do you think that Diontae Johnson gets a normal wide receiver's amount of snaps in this game?
That's the million-dollar question in terms of, hey, if you're gambling on this game, all right, if Davis Mills starts and you've still got, I don't know why they would rest any of the offensive linemen. I'm curious to see where those guys went on vacation, by the way, but on this little mini bye week.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that. I'd like Diontae Johnson to get as ingrained in the offense as possible, so he doesn't need any rest. He got a good chunk of rest up there in Baltimore.
Resting all year, yeah.
So I would just say, let's go find that magical Davis Mills Diontae Johnson connection if CJ's not going
to
play.
So it's going to lead us to the promised land, the mm-hmm. Davis Mills Diontae Johnson connection. All right, let's get to headlines. Rockets lose to the Heat last night, but there was a fight at the end of the game. We'll hear from all the parties involved on that. What does the NFL playoff picture look like after this weekend? Hall of Fame finalists. We got a lot of stuff to get into in headlines, and we will do it next.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
All right, Rockets lose last night to the Miami Heat. Take that music down a little bit, Jordan. That's a little bit loud. Rockets lose to the Miami Heat last night. That was the big story locally. This was another game, 104-100, the final score. The game played kind of in the mid-90s for most of the fourth quarter, and then a lot of technical fouls and free throws at the end of the game because there was a fight.
Yeah.
There was a fight at the end of this game. The Rockets blew a double-digit lead in the second half, and the Heat were up 4 points with under a minute to go in the game, and the Rockets are trying to inbound the ball. And Fred VanVleet gets called for a 5-second violation when he was clearly signaling for a timeout before 5 seconds, I thought. And so did the announcers on the game, Craig Ackerman and Ryan Hollins.
Udoka certainly thought so.
Udoka thought so. VanVleet thought so enough to where he got teed up and got kicked out of the game. Udoka eventually got kicked out of the game as well because on one of the ensuing inbounds plays, with, 20 seconds to go or so, something like that, Amen Thompson and Tyler Hero of the Heat got into it with each other, grabbing each other's jerseys, and then eventually Amen Thompson tossed Tyler Hero to the ground. Like, pretty hard. Yeah, pretty hard.
Yeah.
Pretty hard. Amen Thompson gets kicked out. Ime Udoka gets kicked out. There's a whole big kerfuffle out there. No punches were thrown, but I'm guessing that Amen Thompson will probably get a suspension of some sort, maybe a game, something like that. There'll be a lot of fines. A lot of charities are going to get some money this week. Here was Ime Udoka after the game on his view of what happened between Thompson and Hero.
I didn't see it live, but I rewatched it, and they were in each other's face, bumping chest a little bit, and one guy stronger than the other.
One guy stronger than the other. I hadn't caught that the first time.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. Here was Tyler Hero's version of what happened.
I guess that's what happens when someone's scoring, throwing dimes, doing the whole thing. So I get mad too.
Okay. he's allowed to do that. His team won, and Tyler Hero was outstanding last night. He scored 27 points. Nine assists in the game. He had a really good game.
It also helped, that the Rockets missed 11 straight shots as part of squandering that lead.
No doubt.
So the fact that it was Amen Thompson, I feel really good about, just because it's not like this is some fake tough guy thing out of him.
No, he's legit.
He's been a scrappy, awesome defender all year long.
Yeah.
And he admitted that there was frustration mounted the way the game was going, and then however heated they were after Fred VanVleet's injustice that he suffered. It was contentious. Look, we know that this team can be scrappy. We know they play good defense. So it's not like all of a sudden I think, oh, look, okay, now they're a real tough team. I think it's more of a highlight. Yeah, a lot of the frustration was mounting because, yet again, they cannot shoot. The shooting of the basketball, kind of an issue in modern basketball,
it is funny.
I found.
You and I have talked a lot about the parallels between the Rockets and the Texans throughout really the whole trajectory of the rebuild. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like from from the time that Deshaun Watson and James Harden requested trades within days of each other, the trajectory of both of these franchises had been very, very similar in terms of they both bottom out. They both bring in coaches that we know you can feel are short-timers before you find the culture setter in Ime Udoka or D'Amico Ryans. And I would say the analogy continues to hold up to this very day, given the fact that the thing that seems to fail these two teams, both good teams by definition, right? They would be, you know, the Rockets would be a high-level playoff team right now if the season ended today. The Texans are a playoff team, and they won their division. So by definition, I know people don't want to hear that about the Texans right now because Wednesday.
At the very least, right. They're in the playoffs.
They're 9-7.
Yeah.
Like, they're not a bad football team. It's similar with the Rockets. And similarly, it's the offense that's failing both of them. You have zero concerns over the dog level of the defensive portions of these teams. And I don't have a concern with the Rockets' dog level overall. I have a major concern with the Texans' dog or swarm level, as we'll call it, with the Texans on the offensive side of the football.
Boy, you talk about the lame duck coaches, too, as far as just the temperament of them. Where, like, Lovie Smith is a Lovie Smith. I got no issues with that. Like, he would have been a perfect bridge coach. But the David Culley and Steven Silas, both, they're gentlemen, I think, it wasn't quite the feel of what you wanted out of your football team.
No.
Or football or basketball team. So with D'Amico, the thought I had as I was listening to an article about the Jets debacle was, man, I wonder if D'Amico in his transition to becoming a head coach would be a lot easier, like a genuine head coach where he's not the defensive coordinator and the head coach, but just the overall head coach. Robert Saleh would be an awesome defensive coordinator to have. And I like Matt Burke. I think he and D'Amico work really well together. Yeah. But D'Amico might just trust Robert Saleh more because of the common ground and shared experiences and everything. And Robert Saleh is a hell of a defensive coordinator. So that's something to monitor a couple weeks from now.
I think
maybe so,
too. I think that's second behind the offensive side of the ball is, should D'Amico Ryans be more of a CEO? You know, should he have less hands-on play-to-play with the defense?
Yeah. And I don't think Robert Saleh is going to get a head coaching opportunity real quick. And it's a shame because none of the Aaron Rodgers or quarterback stuff in general was his fault at all. And yet, I think he lost a lot of his shine as a head coach just because it was such a debacle and a mess the entire time.
Yeah, it sucks. If your team doesn't get the quarterback situation right, it's going to reflect poorly on your record. Speaking of the NFL, playoff picture coming into focus. The Colts are out. They lost to the Giants yesterday, so they are out of the playoffs. The Chargers clinched a spot on Saturday against New England, and there is, according to the computers, a 20% chance that the Texans could see the Chargers in the first round of the playoffs. The heavy favorite right now is that it'll be the Steelers coming to town. We talked about this a little bit in the open, but the preference, the Payne and Pendergast preference seems to be, at least in terms of matching up with rosters, the Steelers would be, you know, just based purely on Russell Wilson versus Justin Herbert, right?
Yeah. Russell Wilson versus Justin Herbert. I think the Steelers defense would probably present more issues than the Chargers defense. But you also brought up the great point of, man, if it's the Steelers, it's going to be half Steelers in that crowd.
Yeah, for sure.
And it may be more because of the way people feel about the team right now. Mm-hmm. And Steelers fans travel. They don't just travel well. They are everywhere.
They're everywhere.
There's probably at least 500,000 Steelers fans in the state of Texas.
I don't know what the percentage
would be. But, yeah, so they come, and definitely in the entire region. So, boy, if you actually want to have a genuine home field advantage, it almost needs to be the Chargers. The Ravens, I think you get the home field advantage. I have no interest in seeing the Ravens.
There's a five, and for the reason Seth's bringing up the Ravens, there's a 5% chance they play. It's going to be one of those three teams.
Yeah.
Heavy favorite is the Steelers to be the team they play. Next would be the Chargers, the Ravens. The Ravens would have to lose to the Browns.
That's where I've flipped, by the way, Sean. I had been saying before that, man, depending on the situation, rest your guys versus Tennessee because that's a classic, okay, last game, meaningless, you get ready. That makes sense, rest some guys.
Sure.
If it's a meaningless game. But I had been saying, I'd rather face the Ravens at home if I want to make a playoff push because that's your best chance at beating the Ravens. I've abandoned all hope of that at this point, and I'm just saying, all right, no, I'd like, okay, let's get at least a victory. You got to do something. I don't need to see the Ravens at home. I don't need to see the Ravens again. Please.
At all. Yeah.
Please, baby Jesus, no. Yes. I just keep them away from me as long as possible.
Want nothing to do with them. 15 Hall of Fame finalists have been named. The class of 2025 will be announced. It's a five-man modern era class, and it include, you know, and then they'll add on a coach and a contributor and things like that. So five of the 15 finalists will end up being Hall of Famers. The big names on the list, Eli Manning is the headliner in terms of name value. Seth has a former teammate on this list, not from the Texans, but from Jacksonville. Fred Taylor makes the final 15, Seth.
I'm not optimistic that he's going to make it just because he's a compiler. People view him as a compiler. He had some brilliant seasons, but without being on a high profile team and without having won a Super Bowl, they don't tend to reward the compilers to the same way they might somebody else from a more dominant team.
No, and they in recent years they've been very friendly to guys who are the opposite of a compiler, like a Terrell Davis getting in, you know, who's four great years and then he got a knee injury. Like, he's in. He's a Hall of Famer. I would say, to me, the biggest lock in this class should be, it's probably Eli, but it should be Luke Kuechly, in my opinion, who I think fits that sort of description that I just had of Terrell Davis in a way. Like, Luke Kuechly didn't leave the game because of injuries that we know of, but he was in the league for, what, like 7 years, and he was a first-team All-Pro practically every year. He was the best inside linebacker in football for like a 6-year period.
Yeah.
He should be the biggest lock, in my opinion.
Kuechly is a slam dunk. Suggs is way up there on the career sacks list. So is Jared Allen. He's been up for about 5 years or so. But
yeah,
I think Jared Allen was a little bit, there's a little bit of Mark Gastineau to his game, I think, in some ways. Not as much substance as a guy like Terrell Suggs.
Yeah, I think, too, when you play for, like, five different teams like he did, you know, like, there is something when you look at these guys and you go, oh, yeah, Reggie Wayne was a Colt his whole career. There's some sort of charm about a guy being with one team his whole career.
You know, the interesting thing about Fred Taylor is that everybody above him in the career rushing yardage
is in.
Everybody that's above him that's eligible is in. Frank Gore's not in, but he's not eligible yet.
Adrian
Peterson, who's not, he's going to make it.
He's a lock. That's the way I've always looked at Fred Taylor, was like, he's the, because I think Gore gets in, like the ultimate compiler, but I think he gets in. Yeah. Fred Taylor, man, good player. Obviously, he's a Hall of Fame finalist. All right, those are your headlines from the weekend.
Boy, okay. Yeah, never mind. We'll go ahead. I just look at the guy above him. Like, Thurman Thomas and Fred Taylor played the exact same number of years.
Yeah.
And yet, it's because Thurman Thomas obviously was on really good teams and had, it's a different story.
Yep. All right. I've started seeing a trend on social media, and it involves C.J. Stroud, and it needs to stop. But it does beg the question, what exactly is wrong with C.J. Stroud this year as compared to last year? We'll get to that coming up next.
It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
All right, appreciate everybody hanging through the break with us. What's wrong with C.J. Stroud? We're going to talk about that in just a second here. I will tell you, and when I say what's wrong with him, like, Chris Sims, I saw a video from Chris Sims this weekend, which was putting a lot of CJ's issues on the surroundings as opposed CJ himself.
Yeah.
And I think both things can be true. I will tell you, Seth, the one thing that I'm seeing a lot of over the last 48, 72 hours that needs to stop, and it won't because it's Twitter. If anything, I'll get copied on more of these now because I'm requesting they stop. These graphics that get put up with CJ's stats from this season in a column next to, say, Blake Bortles' stats from his second season in the NFL.
Oh.
And they pick out.
I hadn't seen that. Yeah.
Blake Bortles. I've seen a lot of Trevor Lawrence. It's basically cherry picking a bunch of quarterbacks who are generally, have been, since CJ came into the league, generally been viewed as inferior to CJ Stroud. Blake Bortles, obviously inferior to C.J. Stroud. I don't even know if Blake Bortles is in the league anymore.
Well, Bortles, the thing about Bortles was that he amassed a lot of garbage time yardage. It was like a record for yards when playing from behind and all that. Yeah.
In his
Trevor
second
Lawrence,
year.
I'll listen to Trevor Lawrence because I think this has been my issue. I long said, well, look, I'm not interested in making excuses for Trevor Lawrence because of his injuries that he's played through. And yet now I find myself saying, well, maybe CJ's a little banged up. I don't know. He's been playing through something. So I'm a bit of a hypocrite there. But I also think that, like with Blake Bortles, or excuse me, with Trevor Lawrence also had offensive line issues and protection issues and everything else. So it's really hard to separate some of CJ's play from the poor pass protection, the lack of speed in the wide receiving core now especially, and everything else. The complete and total absence of a run game is really, I think, the most devastating thing, because CJ's still done some really good things. It's just a lot of it's on third and long because they're in third and long all the time because they can't run the football.
Yeah, the only thing I would say, like, specific to Trevor Lawrence, and Trevor Lawrence in his second year, got the Jags to the postseason, went on that great run at the end of the year, you know, where they won like 5 out of 6, and he was very good for that stretch. The only thing I would say, and like making an injury excuse for CJ, is that Trevor Lawrence never touched the level that CJ was last year. Like, Trevor Lawrence has never been mentioned in conversations about top 5 or even barely top 10 quarterbacks, whereas CJ came into this year and a lot of people were expecting a top 5 quarterback performance, and they haven't gotten that. So with CJ and the injuries, I don't view them as much as excuses as reasons. Like, if it were to turn out at the end of the year that he went in for some sort of procedure right after the year was over, I would feel relief that we would maybe now have an explanation for him missing some of the easy throws, or at least easy for him. He made them look easy last year. Like, he, in that Baltimore game, he missed. There was a period in the first half where he missed like 4 passes in a row. Well, no, then he missed 4, like 4 bad incompletions, and the only completion in that stretch was one that maybe should have been intercepted if Dalton Schultz doesn't snare the ball and moss the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he missed them to everybody. He sailed one to Nico. He sailed a wheel route to Joe Mixon. He missed John Mechie on a pass. Like, it wasn't one of these things where he's throwing it to a guy. Like, if he had missed 3 straight passes to Deontay Johnson, if he were active in that game, I'd have been like, all right, well, they're just not on the same page. You know, these are guys who were wide open, and he's sailing these balls. So if there were to be something after the year, Seth, that were medical, I would be a lot more relieved about some of the things that I do think are CJ's fault. He's got to make those throws.
The thing that where I'm open to injuries being at least part of the explanation, it goes all the way back to his misfire to Tank Dell in the Detroit game, where it's sometimes when a quarterback just doesn't feel right, that's where there's a little bit of hesitancy to pull the trigger on some of the big time throws. And on that play, it just felt like, man, he waited too long to make the decision, and then he did not, and then he didn't throw a good ball on top of it. the game the other day, the interception that he threw, man, that was going to be a risky throw. And he was out on the run, scrambling. But I feel like he's regressed a little bit, because, like, on that play, he had time to plant his foot and throw it, but he kind of threw it on the run because there was pressure. But, all right, does he now feel that pressure more intensely because he's been hit so many times and because he's banged up because of those hits? It's just, it's not an excuse for the sum total of it all, but it would at least be a reasonable explanation for why there's some things that just aren't right. There's just too many times where, even on the incompletion of Dalton Schultz in the flat, where Dalton was wide open.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Yes, it's a tight pocket. Yes, Laremy Tunsil was getting trucked backwards badly, and CJ was getting hit as he threw it. But I feel like there's a version of CJ that takes a half step to get away from it and then throws it, or steps up in the pocket a little bit to make that throw. And I just don't know if it's either a lack of timing or trust or whatever else it is. Some of these hard throws, he's not making any easier on himself. Yeah. And it's just everything's off. Now, Dalton Schultz didn't get out of the backfield as quickly as he normally would on that because Laramie's getting trucked backwards and Dalton's checking for the blitz. There's just so many things that are off with the tight ends, with the wide receivers, with the offensive line that it's... some of it might be injury, but some of it also might be that CJ is just his clock is screwed up now.
This has been the hardest season in recent memory for me to watch other teams play football, especially other teams that run this system to play football. Like I can watch other games, you know, during seasons like 2021 or 2022 and not get angry because the Texans are just a bad football team. You know, like it's whatever, it's a rebuild. I know the Texans need a lot more pieces to even be comparable to these other teams that I'm watching play. But, you know, I'm watching Green Bay and Minnesota yesterday, and I'm watching Minnesota just operate with Sam Darnold and with Cam Akers making big plays at the end of that. Cam Akers had a touchdown, and he had the catch that sealed the deal, that basically made it so that Minnesota could just take knees. He was the guy that was in at the end of the game, not Aaron Jones. It was Cam Akers. So there were a few things to get a little upset about in that game. But the main thing, because it's not just that game, it's other games. It's teams that aren't even considered very good NFL offensive teams. But at least they're operating in a way that doesn't make everything look hard. Everything looks hard. With even the plays that they convert, you know, even the third and 15s that they convert, it's usually something of CJ. There's usually some element of CJ having to navigate some massive difficulty in order to do it and put a cape on in order to convert those plays. That's what's so infuriating to watch. Is it's now the Texans are a relevant team. They're a playoff team. We've seen good offense at times, mostly last season with this team. How is it that these other teams that are very average offensively at least make their at least on first and 10, they hand it off and like, wow, there's an easy 7-yard run. That never happens with the Houston Texans.
Honestly, the Cam Akers scenario and the fact that they traded him away is still so puzzling to me. I mean, you look at him versus Damian Pierce. It's not like Cam Akers is having an all-pro season or anything. And he's only averaging 3.9 yards per attempt. But he's got 98 rushing attempts to Damian Pierce's 21.
I'll sum it up. So you can put him on the field.
Yeah.
You can't put Damian Pierce on the field. You know why I know that? They're not putting Damian Pierce on the field.
Well, Cam Akers has 12 receptions to Damian's 2.
Right.
Cam Akers, at the very least, provides you some kind of dual threat at the running back position that, and maybe, you know, with the Texans, he's going to have to manufacture a lot of that yardage, but I feel like he's at least capable of it. Compared to the two-headed monster they have for backup running back of Ogunbowale and Damian Pierce, it's not a great backup running back situation.
No.
But the run game in total, and this is where, the whole thing with Bobby Slowick was we said all offseason, all right, it's very promising. He still has to prove that he can engineer a good rushing attack. Now I'm like, okay, good would be awesome. A good rushing attack would be incredible. But we know that it's not.
Be good.
Games in which Joe Mixon has over 100 rushing yards, we're still saying, like, man, they did not run the ball well.
Right.
Because it's Joe Mixon has a couple big runs, but, man, they're not churning out yardage. And it's putting the offense in third and long, second and long way too often. That's one of the things that I know individually the offensive linemen are not playing well, obviously. But there's plenty of teams that run the ball better than the Texans who have journeyman offensive line across the board, or at least one or two really good linemen, but not other guys to write home about. There's a disjointedness that it's impossible for me not to look at the whole operation and say, at the end of the day, Bobby Slowick's not getting enough out of these guys.
Yeah.
I don't care. As angry as I get at individual offensive linemen, to be as bad as they are in the run game and to be as bad as they are at some of the simple things in the passing game, when you couple that with the tight ends and the wide receivers and everything else, is there a position group on the offense right now that you feel good about? Even before Stephon Diggs and Tank Dell got injured, you still didn't feel great about the wide receiving group other than Nico Collins.
Right. Well, you and I led into this. I would have said quarterback, but the lead into this segment was what's wrong with CJ right now?
Right. Yeah. I don't.
And just to be very clear, so it doesn't get misconstrued or twisted, I still feel great about CJ Stroud as the future quarterback of this football team.
Yeah.
There's a big element, and I was feeling it during that Ravens game, and I was seeing it during the Ravens game on social media and just talking to people. I think there is a big element for people right now that feels like, A, this offense ain't getting fixed this year, and B, everybody just needs a big reset, especially on the offensive side of the ball.
Look, I just, and this is where, when you talk about, there's just so many things off that you can make an excuse for somebody. You can make an excuse for somebody on the team almost every single down. And I'll criticize Bobby sometimes for not attacking the middle of the field enough. But then you get into that game on Wednesday, and there's times where, yeah, they're supposed to be quick hitters over the middle and mesh concepts and stuff. But even in versus a four-man rush, where CJ's taking the ball in the gun, taking two steps backwards, and he's getting hit at the top of his drop when he's trying. Like, the defensive linemen are coming free so quickly and ferociously up the middle at times that you can't even throw over the middle. It's just so frustrating. Yeah. When I'm watching on TV, I wanted to blame CJ for not getting rid of the ball quickly enough. But then I'm watching the game, and he's got Xavier Hutchinson open on a target, but Kyle Van Noy is on CJ as he would be starting his motion, and it's just you can't function that way,
right?
You just can't function that way.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Like, what on the offensive side of the football? What group do you feel good about right now? I probably when healthy. Even when they weren't moving the football all that great with Tank and Stephon Diggs both still healthy, I felt good about that room. You know, like, those are three good receivers.
Well,
now it's Nico and a bunch of dudes, you know. And
the thing about when they had the three guys out there, or just even two of them, they were still affecting the offense, even though the passing game, or affecting the defense, where the passing game wasn't what you wanted to be. But, man, they're facing cover two all the time, and you should be able to run the ball versus that. You should be able to complete short stuff, but they couldn't even do that because of the ineptitude of the blocking. And by the blocking, I'll say by the offensive line, the tight ends, the running backs, all of it. And then you add on to that, you know, Joe Mixon, I could make some of the same excuses for Joe Mixon that I make for C.J. Stroud.
Yeah.
I don't think Joe Mixon's always doing a great job of making the right read. But then you're like, my knee-jerk reaction is, but yeah, he's hardly ever getting good looks in front of him. And I think he and CJ both at times are pressing too hard to try to get the big shots. And it's a quagmire.
I don't feel great about any room on that side of the football. And yet I feel like if they fix the offensive line room, that has an effect on all the others.
Yeah.
You know, I saw there's a cut out there that I think a lot of, if you're a football fan and you're on social media, you've probably seen. I think it's from the draft, or it was after Jim Harbaugh was named the head coach of the Chargers.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was at the draft of the combine, when all the coaches do availabilities at the press conference, or they sit down for breakfast with the reporters there in the room. And Harbaugh has a great cut, and this is, and he kind of tipped his hand as to what they were going to do in the draft, because they end up drafting Joe Alt, the tackle from Notre Dame, to go with Rashawn Slater as their other tackle. So they got their bookend tackles for the next several years. And he said that basically, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, but offensive line is the one position that everybody else is dependent upon. You know, the other positions, they're not dependent on you. I mean, there is some interdependency with each position, but none more so than that group, and that is why we're going to build through the offensive line. And I think, in terms of intentionality, I think the Texans have made an effort to do that in the last couple of years. It's just they're either being coached by the wrong guys, or they are the wrong guys.
Because
it ain't getting done with this group right now.
I think the frustrating thing is that, you know, I'll say that, hey, you don't have to have all pros across the board. It's good enough to have a couple of studs and a few journeymen. But in this scheme, the frustrating thing is that usually you actually do get some really good performances out of average offensive linemen if they're good for the scheme and if it's being coached right. That's where I think in the offseason, if they don't make a change at offensive coordinator, I'll be astounded if they don't make a change at offensive line coach.
Agreed.
And it's almost, I mean, this comes back to D'Amico's hiring. Chris Strausser had never coached in a system like this. You talk to offensive linemen, this goes back to when I was playing against this scheme or talking to Gary Kubiak about it. It's way more complicated than just what you draw up on the board. Somebody once told me that it was, you know, you can learn the playbook in a half hour. It'll take you decades to really learn how to block all of it.
Yes.
And there's a lot of technique involved. There's a lot of mental work involved. And when you have an offensive line coach who's never coached in a system like this before, it's hard to pick up on the fly and expect that he's all of a sudden going to be an Alex Gibbs senior. It's just, it's not that simple or easy.
Anybody who's ever been in management at any level, not just in football, but in business, knows hiring is a skill that you get better at over time. You get better at hiring people over time. Like, and it's normal, I think, for first time head coaches. It's normal for them to have a list of guys they would want to go coach with. You know, like D'Amico's probably been putting his list together during his time in San Francisco through the years.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if he hadn't been. Like, if any of these coaches, college or pro, don't have a list of guys, like, boy, when I get my head coaching job, these are my first 10 phone calls I'm making because I want this guy. We've talked about it at all the clinics we've been to. Someday we're going to coach together. Bobby and D'Amico probably talked about it in those rooms when they were quality control guys. Like, someday. Doesn't mean they're the right guys. You know, like, you get better at hiring over time, and I think that's got to be the hope if you're a Texan fan, is that the same way you hope that CJ improves at this, or Nico improves at that, or Will Anderson Jr. gets better at the top of his edge rush, you hope that D'Amico Ryans gets better at identifying coaching talent and what fits what he wants to do here.
The other thing that happens with coaching is that the problem is people have contracts. And a lot of times your dream list of offensive line coaches, you know, the top five guys on there, there's a good chance they're all under contract, you know? Jeff Stoutland, the Eagles offensive line coach, probably not getting fired anytime soon. You know, it's just like he's not there. The one thing that's curious to me about the Texans' run game is that I don't believe they have a run game coordinator specifically. And, I don't know what's going to happen with Kyle Shanahan, but Chris Forrester is the offensive line coach and run game coordinator for the 49ers. He's been around forever. And that's a guy where hopefully he's on D'Amico's list.
Yeah.
That, all right, guys that could become available this offseason that if you got a chance, just money whip that dude. Get a guy in here who actually knows what he's doing. If you're not going to make a change at coordinator.
Agreed. All right, let's acknowledge. Let's do some little positivity here. Acknowledge some big performances from over the weekend. We need the music there, Jordan. There we go. All right, so the way this works, if you listen on Mondays, you know, we acknowledge big performances or things we liked from over the weekend. Sometimes we acknowledge long-term performance in retirement. That'll happen in this segment right here. But I read a name. Jordan, who's producing today, plays...
Acknowledge me!
And we acknowledge why we are acknowledging these people. Let's start with Saquon Barkley.
Acknowledge me!
We acknowledge Saquon Barkley, Seth, for becoming the ninth running back in NFL history to go over 2,000 yards in a season. He is 105 yards away from Eric Dickerson's single-season record. We will acknowledge as well that it's a 17-game season now, not a 16-game season like it was with Eric Dickerson back in the day. But it's fair to say that the Saquon Barkley acquisition is working out as well as the Eagles possibly could have imagined and as poorly as the New York Giants possibly could have imagined.
Yeah, the one thing that John Mara didn't want to have happen, but his GM kept telling him it has to happen for so many good reasons. Because most of all, let's be real, Saquon Barkley is washed up. He's 27 years old. What could you expect to get out of him?
Why would you pay?
And who's going to want him?
Right.
He also said that multiple times. Who's going to want him anyway?
We can't
trade him.
Turns out the Eagles wanted him. Why would you pay for that? I believe one of the other quotes uttered. We're going to hear some of the audio here in a second. One of the other quotes uttered by Joe Shane: do I want to pay $40 million to my quarterback to hand off to a $12 million running back?
Right.
I'll point out that $40 million quarterback is a Minnesota Viking now. He's not even on the Giants anymore. He's not even a Giant. Here's probably the most noteworthy exchange between Giants GM Joe Shane. This is from Hard Knocks offseason. Giants GM Joe Shane, an owner of the Giants, and probably the biggest Saquon Barkley fan in the world, John Mara.
What's the latest? Just on the Saquon thing.
I just got a text that Chicago's driving the price up and Philly's out. I don't know if that's true or not.
Liar.
Which I don't know. I'll make a couple of calls. I don't even know if that's going to happen, but...
I'm going to have a tough time sleeping if Saquon goes to Philadelphia. I'll tell you that, as I've told you, just being up. I have been around enough players. But he's the most popular player we have by far.
Yeah.
Joe Shane didn't want to hear about popularity. that was not registering. That was not, dude, the more we play that cut, the more Joe Shane in the very beginning sounds like a guy who is totally lying and doesn't even... He just thinks, like, this old man's going to believe me. He'll believe me.
I'll tell you, man, just that right there, there's so many moments from that Hard Knocks where these are conversations that would have been had. We just wouldn't have been privy to them. Right. So, like, let's pretend that this was never on HBO Hard Knocks, but these were the conversations that Joe Shane is having with John Mara, where he's just continually, over the course of that HBO Hard Knocks offseason, kind of pulling the wool over John Mara's eyes about the situation. And Joe Shane is repeatedly telling people on his own staff, no, nobody's going to want him. Why would Philly want Saquon Barkley? No, they're not going to go after him. So, like, he was so wrong in so many respects, which happens, except that you also get a sense that, man, it felt like he was actively misleading him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, actively 100%. Misleading John Mara.
100%.
And not to mention, but then not even misleading it, saying, we've got to find out what we have in Daniel Jones, the guy that I paid without apparently knowing what we have in him.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's gone, which is what's so crazy about these reports that Joe Shane's job is safe.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
It's crazy.
Somebody's got to grab John Mara by his little fancy lad prep school blazer,
yeah,
and say, he is making a fool of you, John Mara.
You can act like a man.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, let's keep it moving. Coach Prime.
Acknowledge me.
I'm going to acknowledge Coach Prime, not for the abysmal performance that Colorado put up in the Alamo Bowl. BYU just took them to the woodshed. And that was with Shador playing quarterback and Travis Hunter playing wide receiver and cornerback. Colorado's guys played in this game, and I will... A partial portion of my acknowledgement is to Coach Prime for having his guys play in the bowl game. I think that's really cool. Now, they played like they were out a lot on the Riverwalk over the last few days. They were not good. This is what has me acknowledging Coach Prime, and this is where I've really come around on him this year as a coach and a leader of young kids, you know, young men, I should say. This was Coach Prime giving his opinion on something he thinks should be mandatory for college athletes.
I think financial literacy classes should be mandatory so these kids understand how to manage their money when they get their money, and I think it should be a pay scale. It should be structured. It can't be just Tom, Dick, and Harry gets this because he had a great year somewhere else. Then that throws off the chemistry and the structure of your whole team. It's just like one of you guys coming out here and some guys from outside come in here and they make more money than you and they hadn't even been doing the work that you've done. It's not fair. And I think the NFL has handled it right, and we need to mimic the NFL when it comes to that, because right now we're not pros, but we're semi-pro. And that's the way it's going. And if we don't get a hold of it, it's going to keep going left. And the teams that don't have the budgets like us, it's going to be hard to sit up here in front of you and then make it to a playoff game, because now it turns into pay-per-view.
And right, that's good. We're good, Jordan. That's right. That's good right there. The last about 30 seconds of that, he's basically saying that college needs a salary cap like the NFL. Like, all teams need to be playing.
Oh, that's
on,
what he says.
Even
the,
playing
he goes
level.
On to say that. Yeah.
No, no.
Yeah,
well, I felt like that's what he was implying by saying the pros got it right. Now we need to mimic the pros.
Oh, I thought he meant in terms of the literacy classes and everything, because there's all kinds of stuff in the off season about educational stuff like that.
Oh, everything. Okay. Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah, probably. Maybe that too. Maybe that too.
That makes, I mean, given what he was talking about, that's what I assumed he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's the Wild West right now in college. And yeah, I mean, from program to program, who knows, like, how many of those guys even realize that they've got to pay self-employment tax and all that, and it's a lot. It's hard enough when you actually get a real job with an employer, you know, to manage your taxes.
Yeah.
But, like, you're all of a sudden making all that money as an independent contractor with all this NIL stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a lot. But then the part that I was intrigued by was when he was talking about the jealousy and everything. Like, that's almost like a financial literacy and philosophy class in one.
Yeah.
Just, you know, understanding and not comparing yourself to others and keeping your eyes on the, it would be very tailored to professional athletes.
I think financial literacy courses should be mandatory in college, period, for every student. I think there's always mandatory. I had to take two theology courses at Notre Dame. Yeah. I had to take PE my freshman year.
Look at how fit and pious you are now because of it.
Right. I never had to at any point. I mean, I was a finance major, but there were no mandatory financial classes. You know,
it is like, funny. Yeah, I think like you can take any number of macro and microeconomics classes, but still not be good about managing your own personal.
Yeah,
finances.
I think it should. Yeah. I think the syllabus should be totally putting the student in the shoes of this is their money, not. This is the economy, you know?
Like, we had, I remember when we were in school, at some point, you know, they had home economics and you had shop class. And they changed it to where they were like, all right, like, listen, times are changing. And I'm guessing a lot of these young women in the 1980s aren't going to go on to be housewives. I think we called it home and careers. So it was like we could still take shop or tech ed, whatever they called it. But there was a separate one that was home and careers, which was everybody took it and you had to learn how to do all the old home economic stuff like cooking and everything. But then there was also balancing your checkbook. There was a financial management side to it.
Yeah.
But it was in like seventh or eighth grade.
Right.
So where it's not quite getting to the point where, you know, you don't have your own checkbook at that point usually. That's at the very, like, your junior or senior year in high school is probably the best time to do that.
Yeah. So Coach Prime, good job on your philosophy. Bad job in the Alamo Bowl. Good job with what you're espousing. Jonathan Fagan. Hey, Jordan. Jonathan Fagan.
Acknowledge me.
We acknowledge Jonathan Fagan. Jonathan Fagan, Rockets beat writer for the Houston Chronicle, hanging it up after 27 years of covering the Rockets. And even longer than that with the Chronicle. I can remember when I moved here in like 1994, 1995, and Jonathan Fagan was doing periodic radio over on one of Dan Patrick's stations, I think with Matt Thomas back in the day. So he's been doing it in Houston even longer than the several, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, even longer than the 27 years he's been covering the team. But man, you can tell a lot, Seth, about the respect level by the way the team that a person covers handles their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan Fagan got an ad in a full page ad in the Chronicle from the Rockets. Ime Udoka tossed a basketball to Jonathan Fagan in the post game press conference after they blew that lead to the Timberwolves on Friday. That was Fagan's last game, I believe. And they honored him last night at the Heat game. You know, center court gave him, you know, I don't recall what they gave him, but they acknowledged him at the game right there at center court. I don't know, Jonathan, really. I probably did a few of those like panel shows with him along the way on TV. You know, you and I have done enough TV. I don't know that he's ever been part of the 610 family here, at least not while I've been here. I always enjoyed reading his stuff. He was excellent. You couldn't ask for anybody better at covering your local basketball team.
No, and I, like, honestly, the simplest thing is what I've always appreciated him the most for is just the game recaps. Like, I feel like he did a really good job of just laying it out exactly what the pertinent issues were without hopping around all over the place. A lot of these young writers are so enamored of all the stats and everything that it turns out it feels like you're reading an advanced box score the whole time. They then throw in a couple of transitions too and call it an article. Like, Fagan would write actual articles every night.
And you
feel like, oh yeah, that was the most important thing in this game. Yeah. Or that was the critical moment in this game. Yes. Thank you, Jonathan.
Usable for guys like us, especially guys like us if it was a West Coast game. And we didn't see the whole thing. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. Like his recaps were awesome. So congrats to Jonathan Fagan, who it sounds like is going to do a lot of traveling in retirement from everything that I've read. He had a really good kind of like final piece that he wrote thanking everybody. If you're a fan of Jonathan Fagan or you're a fan of the Rockets, go out of your way to find it. It was really, really good. Congratulations to him on a great career in an industry where it is really hard to go out on your own terms. And he's going out on his own terms. So good for him.
He should have thrown the ball back to Udoka, like he's checking the ball.
In the press.
Just rifle it back at him aggressively.
If they'd won that game, then maybe. Like, blew a 16-point lead. Greg Gumbel.
Acknowledge me.
R.I.P. Greg Gumbel passes away over the weekend. If you're a sports fan at all in town, you know Greg Gumbel because it feels like he called 100 Texans games over the last several years. Passes away in his late 70s. Cancer. He'd been suffering from cancer over the last several months, year or two maybe. He'd been off the air for a while. I would say, Seth, synonymous with March Madness. That's probably the thing he's most known for, is hosting that studio show with whoever through the years. But the last few years, it's been Kenny Smith, Charles Barkley, Clark Kellogg. Obviously, a big part of the NFL coverage. He was part of the nearly original group at SportsCenter back in the day, in the 80s. That's where I graduated high school with his daughter, because he worked in Bristol.
That's right,
he worked in Bristol, Connecticut, so they lived in my town. So Michelle Gumbel is a classmate of mine. Probably best known in Houston, or maybe not best known, but if as far as like Houston calls go that are iconic, Greg Gumbel on the kiss of death in 1995.
Talk to the Phoenix bench. How wide open was Akeem Olajuwon on the play, though?
Mario Elie. Is that the stake through the heart for a second straight season by the Houston Rockets?
There you go. Kiss of death, man. One of the, I would say, one of the three or four most famous plays in the history of this city, the Mario Elie kiss of death. And Greg Gumbel was the one on the call for that one.
And also, Jimmy Carter passed away yesterday as well.
Let's acknowledge Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter.
Acknowledge me.
100. He made it to triple digits, right? He was a hundo.
Yeah, he was in rough shape the last few years.
Yes.
Always, you know, when people have Alzheimer's. He's just from a personal standpoint, he was the first president that I was ever aware of that was a president. Because I was 5 years old in 1980, so I was like old enough to know who the president was and that there was going to be a new president. That was all I knew.
I
didn't know who the hell Gerald Ford was.
I
was an infant when he was. Gerald Ford was the first president you were like consciously aware of.
Consciously aware of. I mean, I remember my parents, like when I was real little, saying stuff about Nixon resigning, like, but I didn't really gather what that was all about.
Yeah,
like Gerald Ford was we elect these officials when they don't resign.
I knew my grandparents were the most political people I knew. So all I knew of Jimmy Carter was that I was not supposed to like Jimmy Carter, which is, hey, that's politics, baby.
it is politics. All right. Look, we can sit here and talk about our issues on offense with the Houston Texans. We can take a look up north and say, well, thankfully, this isn't us. The exit strategy has begun. For a former Texan, we will have that for you coming up next.
Payne and Pendergast is driven by West Point Lincoln at Katy Freeway. 1 mile west of the Beltway, exit Kirkwood, under the giant American flag. It's a Shoppers John Deere Reaction Monday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
We're going to hand things over to John Harris and Mark Vandermeer in just a little bit. Hey, quick update. We didn't get to this in headlines, but quick update. Up in Cleveland, they've still got roughly $170 million worth of cap dollars allocated to Deshaun Watson spread out over God knows how many years, with voidable years and everything else.
Yeah.
They did a little restructure over the last few days. Here's Ian Rappaport of the NFL Network.
Week, as it pertains to their quarterback position, agreed to terms with Deshaun Watson on an adjusted contract. No, he did not give up his $92 million fully guaranteed. What this did was ease the cap burden in a couple years in the event he is no longer the quarterback for them. But what this really did was make sure everyone knew Deshaun Watson will be back in Cleveland next year. I would expect some competition, though. Wouldn't be surprised if it's veteran competition. Aaron Rodgers, if he's not on the Jets, would be one potential option. Kirk Cousins, Rich, another one.
I am so here for Deshaun Watson competing for a starting position in the NFL next training camp.
I mean, you know what, though? Maybe, who knows? Maybe that'll end up being what's best for him.
It might be.
If I'm in Cleveland, you got to talk yourself into things. And there's a high ceiling with Deshaun Watson. Somewhere in there is the guy who is still young, he's still young. That has had a lot of promise and played really well in a lot of regards in 2020. But where the Browns are right now with him, yeah, if they could, they would. If they could part with him, they would. But you know what this is, Sean? This is like trying to get divorced during COVID. Remember the divorce rates just plummeted? And it was like, because there's so much stuff going on. Now, a lot of seeds were planted for getting divorced in the future, I'm sure.
And they will get divorced in the future as well.
Yeah, right. But during COVID, I mean, people were like, the finances were dicey.
Yeah.
It was hard to even schedule an appointment with anybody that could help you get divorced. It was just, the divorce rates plummeted like 54%.
Yeah.
And then they rebounded very quickly post-COVID. But yeah, that's where they are. They're in the middle of a bad marriage in the middle of COVID, and the finances just won't allow them to divorce. So they got to try to make do and just not murder each other because they're trapped in the same room with each other for however long the Deshaun Watson contract pandemic lasts.
Deshaun Watson's contract is a pandemic, is what it is. It's a pandemic. Yeah. And so without getting into the nerdy details of what Cleveland and Deshaun agreed to, none of the overall money changes. He's still getting his $92 million that he's guaranteed. Not a penny more, not a penny less. They just kind of spread it out differently. Texans Cap sent me a long summary of what it all means. And basically it means they're going to be together for another couple years because it's impossible for a team to take as big a cap hit as the Browns would take to get rid of him. But when the time does come to move on, unless he plays well in 2025 or 2026, maybe he does. Maybe he gets right. Who the hell knows? But if this is all going the direction we anticipate it's going, the eventual release of Deshaun Watson, while painful, can be at least spread out with some June 1st kind of stuff and things like that when 2027 rolls around. This is the worst contract in the history of team sports. It's so bad. And they've handled it so bad by jamming so much of it into the future.
The Broncos giving all that money to Russell Wilson was weird, and it was bad, but they could recover from it.
They have.
Whereas this one, obviously. No, well, from the financial side, they're still suffering the ramifications of it, but still, they were able to move on within a couple years.
They're winning games,
Right. Where this is just, it's impossible because it was all guaranteed. It was a bold move, and it just blew up in their faces spectacularly.
It was a bold move.
We'll see.
You never know.
I'm not going to be sitting here and acting like, nope, Deshaun Watson's all washed up, no chance, and then the Texans play them next year.
I got no
taste for that.
Throws for 350. I'm with you.
There's still that Deshaun Watson is in there somewhere.
It's like Darth Vader. There's good in him still.
Yes.
So D'Amico's meeting with the media today at 12:30, I believe. He's going to get asked about CJ playing in this game. What do you think the answer is? Do you think?
Oh, he's going to hold it close to his vest and not say anything.
Yeah.
And then they're going to have given the dirty eye to Aaron Wilson.
For asking the question?
Waiting to see.
The news?
Just waiting to see until he breaks the news or whatever that, now, this one, maybe they won't play it super close to the vest just because you don't really gain anything from winning or losing this game. So they might, for CJ's sake, if CJ doesn't play in this game, I'm guessing he's going to have to be talked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this clip of Ryan Fitzpatrick this weekend, and I tried to go back and find it this morning, and I couldn't, but he was on Andrew Whitworth's podcast, and Fitzpatrick was talking about a time where he had tried to play through a rib injury, and he just didn't want to come off the field. He felt he owed it to the team, and it was his responsibility to play. And he said in hindsight, he realized, all right, at that point, I was hurting the team. And it sounds like a weird thing to say, but I kind of hope CJ is really banged up right now, because that is an explanation, at least a partial explanation, for how bad he was the other night.
Yeah.
And that it's the best thing for the team for him to get as healthy as possible. So if they go out there and he says it today, it just like CJ can be at peace with it, not have to worry about it, not have to lie to the media about it, just roll into this whole week making Davis Mills the guy.
Yep, we'll see. 12:15, by the way. 12:15 is D'Amico Ryan's today. I'm sure you'll hear it, at least portions of it, right here during In the Loop on Sports Radio 610. Seth, we got to hand it over to John and Mark. Antibodies to you, my friend.
Antibodies to you as well, and I hope you don't get divorced during the next pandemic.
Should not, but I think I'm in good shape, especially after Christmas. I think I'm doing good.
Good job.
Thank you.
Big spender.
All right. We are done. We are out of time. Thanks to Jordan for producing today. Seth, we'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. John Harris and Mark Vandermeer, they're up next. It's a Texans Monday here on Sports Radio 610. See you tomorrow, everybody.